As a church, we've been working our way through the book of Ecclesiastes, which is part of what's called the wisdom literature in the Bible. And we've learned up till now about how chasing after promotion, pleasure, money, and things is like trying to chase after the wind itself. The writer, who calls himself the teacher, says that none of these things are wrong in themselves, but when they become our focus and our purpose, we can wake up one morning and find that our lives look pretty meaningless. This week, we're looking at wisdom and folly. The teacher's view is that wisdom and righteousness are related, as are foolishness and wickedness. He goes on to suggest that we're made of a bit of both. In fact, no one on earth is righteous, he says. No one always does what is right and never sins. He also recognizes something we see in our lives, that good things can happen to bad people and bad things can happen to good people. His conclusion, though, is surprising and not really what we'd expect to see in the Bible. He effectively suggests that we should embrace our humanity, cut ourselves some slack, and whilst not advocating that we dive right into a pit of depravity, don't wear ourselves out with trying to be so righteous that we forget to live. And whilst we're at it, we should cut others some slack too. You know yourself, he says, that you've taken part in gossip. So don't get het up if someone's talking about you behind your back. Now, some of that sounds like good sense. In fact, that last bit sounds quite like Jesus saying, don't try to take the speck out of your own eye until you've removed the plank from your own. But is the teacher going as far as to suggest that we don't need to worry about a wee bit of sin? Just don't go overboard. So long as you fear God, he'll keep you right. As we explore further, we see that the teacher says, all this I tested by wisdom. I am determined to be wise. But then we learn that the teacher looked for wisdom, but it was beyond him. Every time he thought he'd grasped it, he only discovered just how little he actually knew. Gaining wisdom was like grasping a few grains of dry sand on a beach, and even what he had seemed to run through his fingers. So he turned his hand instead to the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. Because as we might agree, it's always easier to find what's wrong in something and what's ridiculous. Because after all, there's plenty of it about. Seeing fools in many high positions is something many of us might have experienced in our working lives, when for some unknown reason, our bosses have decided to give a senior position to the last person on earth you would ever give that job to. The one who can't manage their way out of a paper bag, never mind look after a team. They talk incessantly. They are full of their own self-importance. They procrastinate, make poor decisions, and just as you've worked out a way how to implement their daft idea, they change their mind. They agree to stupid things in important meetings and create work for everyone else. Inevitably, the team are going to have to work extra hard to sort out the mess, after which, of course, they'll get the credit. It's the same sort of frustration we feel when we see politicians acting in a way that doesn't befit their post. It's embarrassing when we hear the House of Commons sounding like a playground. And on an international level, when world leaders from a range of countries act like spoilt children, sending taunts over social media, sacking people who won't play their games, pulling out of deals on a whim, and sending their submarines down places they shouldn't be just to show off their power. It feels out of order. And we can empathize with the teacher when he says that the words these leaders speak multiply till we're all uneasy about what is coming next or what will happen. Similarly, we see often years, weeks, months of careful planning, negotiation, or proposals undone by someone who sticks their size 10s in, totally unaware of the sensitivities. And so the whole thing falls apart like the accidental nudge of a domino in your domino rally. So we can agree, I hope, that putting the foolish in important positions is itself foolish, and that when they're in these positions, the foolish people's words are dangerous. But when we start to look a little bit deeper into the passage, there are some more uncomfortable points in there, and more so if we read the whole section. The teacher seems to have an assumption that typically it is noble and rich people who are wise, whilst the poor are more likely to be foolish. It's through their folly and laziness that they can't maintain their houses, not through poverty. For slaves to be able to ride a horse is an anathema. They don't deserve that. Even if you're poor and wise like our man in the all-age talk, no one's going to remember you. Because to be remembered, you have to be rich and powerful and wise. And you shouldn't get ideas above your station. Woe to the land whose king was a servant. The teacher might have been writing these words in ancient times, but they still ring true today. We still have a culture that suggests that the better off are better educated, whether through opportunity or culture. And whilst we would admire someone who starts in lowly circumstances and works their way up to the top, the very fact that we celebrate it suggests that it's not as common as it should be. Even looking at our political system drawn from the Roman Republic, we have a House of Lords to check that the commoners aren't putting through anything foolish. Now, having checks and counterbalances is important and it's good, but it's interesting what our political structure says about our assumptions regarding wisdom. But let's get back to the passage and look closely at the type of words the teacher uses. He talks of having seen, tested, turned his mind to understand, to investigate, to search, and to find. The teacher is not pulling these ideas out of the ether. It's not an abstract reflection on wisdom and folly. It's based on a critical analysis of what he sees and experiences around him. It's an accurate reflection of what's going on under the sun, as he puts it. This is why his reflections make so much sense, because it's the same worldview we're surrounded by and immersed in. And it's important we have it in the Bible, because it helps us to see that whilst we might have moved on with technology and progressed in all sorts of ways, there's nothing new under the sun about how we think about ourselves and our behaviour. But what happens if we put a new lens on this? What if we look at what the teacher says in parallel with the life of Jesus? First, we have the picture of the slaves on horseback whilst princes walk. What happens if we compare that for a minute against Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem on a donkey? Scholars Borg and Crossan reckon that at the same time Jesus entered Jerusalem, on the other side of the city, Pilate was entering through another gate. And his parade was intended to be a strategic show of power and strength when the city was going to be full of worshippers, including some of those who would love dearly for the Roman government to be overthrown. So what comment was Jesus making about the worldview of power and wisdom by coming in on a donkey? Next, there's the declaration of woe that would befall a town where their king was previously a servant. How does that compare with Jesus saying, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all? Especially when he then hammers at home by getting down on his knees and washing his disciples' feet after a day of walking about on dirt roads, a job usually done by a slave. Whilst the teacher concludes from his research that the wealthy and powerful should be wise and hold the high positions, and it seems foolish and even downright wrong to him when things don't follow that order, Jesus is showing us that it's the assumptions the teacher is basing his conclusions on that are downright wrong. Those who have power shouldn't forget their own fragility and should serve the weaker in society, not lord it over the rest of us. This radical sort of wisdom doesn't and won't make sense to everyone, particularly if you're the one that's going to have to relinquish the power. But this is the type of kingdom or world order that Jesus came to bring. As Paul says in his first letter to the church in Corinth, the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and that God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. Perhaps this is why the teacher couldn't find true wisdom. Perhaps that's why it was so elusive, because he was trying to find it under the sun, and true wisdom is only found when we look through the sun, Jesus Christ. As believers, we are called to be part of bringing a different way of seeing life and to be wise enough to know that it won't make sense to everyone, to recognize that not everyone will embrace it. The period of Lent starts on Wednesday, where believers remember that for 40 days Jesus spent time in the wilderness. It's also the start of the lead up to Holy Week and Easter, where Jesus does the very things we've just discussed. He enters the city on a donkey. He washes the disciples' feet. And he does what many considered to be complete madness. He gives up his life to suffer death on a cross. A humiliating, cruel and torturous death designed only for political dissidents, terrorists and full-on gangsters. I'm not aware of any other movement in history that started with what appears to be the utter defeat of their leader. And yet here we are, over 2,000 years later, believing that Jesus died and rose again. Because as the teacher said, none of us have been able to get through life always doing what is right and never sinning. No one that is, except Jesus. So the one who never put a foot wrong became sin, to put sin itself to death. And God then raised him from the dead, triumphing over death, so that neither sin nor death could rule over us. And though this can be hard for us to compute, this sets us free to live life as God intended, because it lets us break free from all that happens under the sun to allow us to live through the sun. Yes, we are still living in a world that holds the view the teacher shows us so eloquently. Yes, we still have to put up with foolish people in powerful positions, but managers and politicians come and go. Their term is temporary. Yes, good things will still happen to bad people, and bad things will still happen to good people. And sometimes these things are tragic, and they don't make sense, and they will never make sense. But sometimes bad things happening, painful as they are at the time, are part of a bigger story that ends better than we could ever expect when we are living through that pain. Let me close with a story about Jock. There was once a farmer who owned a small arable farm in the Borders. One spring, the horse he relied on to plough the fields ran away. Well, the villagers came round to console him. "That's terrible, Jock. How will you manage, Jock? Oh, that's awfully bad luck, Jock." To which Jock just replied, "I will. We'll see." Well, the next week, Jock's out in the front garden, sharpening the blade of his plough, when who should come trotting up the path but his horse and two wild horses with it. Well, before you know it, there are all the neighbours round congratulating Jock on his good fortune. But all Jock said was, "Aye, we'll see." So the son took it upon himself to train these wild horses, but one of them threw him and he broke his leg in the fall. And yes, you've guessed it. The neighbours are all up consoling him, commiserating and saying how awful it was, to which Jock replied, "I will, we'll see." Now the neighbours had no sooner left than was a knock at the door, and it was the conscripting soldiers looking to take away any young men to the war. Well, they took one look at Jock's son with his broken leg and turned on their heel and left, because they didn't want an invalid. Once again, the neighbours hurried up to his house to tell him how lucky he was when the sons and neighbours and grandsons that they had been carted off to war. And Jock just replied, "I will. We'll see." And I think this story illustrates really well our recurring theme in this challenge of Ecclesiastes. Are we getting frustrated about the foolishness of the world, the things under the sun that often we can't control? Or are we looking at life from Jesus' perspective, through the sun? For this, I think, is where we find true wisdom. So my challenge to you as we enter Lent is to take time to consider two things. First, are we letting our circumstances rule our actions? Or are we seeking Jesus' perspective and wisdom on our circumstances? And secondly, are we actively working to help others see that there's more to life than what we see under the sun, that there is a different way of living? Let's pray together. God of all wisdom, help us to understand that your ways are not our ways. Your wisdom is beyond our understanding when we only see and learn from what is around us. Help us, Lord, to see things through your eyes, to actively live our lives according to your wisdom, and through this, to enable others to see there is more to this life than meets the eye. For your glory, we ask this. Amen.